Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Carolina, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Metastatic Colorectal Cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and your interest that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have over 795 participants on the call today, so this is a very large call, and you come from all over the United States. Really hundreds of you from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, China, India, Kuwait, and the United Kingdom. So a global call all over the world. And I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing. And there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations as a resource for you. And that's really important that you have that information, those resources, that you can contact those organizations for help as well. There also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the conclusion of a program today and complete the evaluation form. You know, we're planning many programs going forward, and indeed, your feedback and your suggestions to us really do tailor our programs. You are our best consultants in terms of what the programs should look like, what topics we should address. So do take a moment and complete those evaluations. You know, we're planning a lot of programs for this year, and indeed the topic for today was one that many of you recommended, and so here it is. So, and today's program was made possible by an educational grant from Genentech Biooncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we are very fortunate to have such wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Peter Ensinger. And Dr. Ensinger is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Clinical Director, Gastrointestinal Cancer Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Ensinger is going to address overview of metastatic colorectal cancer, current standard of care, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Ensinger.
Thank you, Carolyn. My pleasure being here today, and welcome to all of you out there in the wide world. I was asked to talk about metastatic colorectal cancer, and we really need to start off by understanding sort of the scope of this disease. In the United States, at least, this is the second most common cancer that men and women are diagnosed with. And basically, the older you are, the higher your risk is for this cancer. For this year, the American Cancer Society estimates that over 100,000 patients will be diagnosed with colon cancer, and over 40,000 patients will be diagnosed with rectal cancer. It accounts for about 9% of all cancers diagnosed in the United States. And fortunately, though, the incidence of this cancer is coming down, primarily due to the efforts of screening. Some have called it the Katie Couric effect. Essentially, we're screening more for colon cancer, and by removing polyps that eventually turn into colon cancer, we have been able to significantly reduce the incidence of this cancer. Now, unfortunately, we still see this cancer, and there are still patients who present with metastatic colorectal cancer, which is basically defined by the fact that the cancer can sometimes spread beyond the local area. So the cancer originates in the colon, but it can spread either through the bloodstream or through the lymphatics, which are basically drainage tubes, to other areas. So particularly colon cancer likes to go to the liver, but it can also make its way after that to the lungs, the bones, distant lymph nodes. Rectal cancer can sometimes bypass the liver and can go directly to the lungs, but also tends to go to these other organs like colon cancer does. Overall, once the cancer is spread to other areas, we sort of call colon and rectal cancer a single entity. We call it colorectal cancer. Generally speaking, when we talk about colorectal cancer or metastatic colorectal cancer, we divide patients into two groups, those patients with oligometastatic disease and those patients with diffuse metastatic disease. patients with oligometastatic disease tend to have isolated lesions in the liver, or with rectal cancer can have isolated lesions in the lung. These are patients where we like to take an aggressive approach. Either we like to operate up front on them, or we give them chemotherapy first and then operate on either the liver or the lung to try to clear the patient of all cancer. Unfortunately, many patients present with cancer that's more diffuse, cancer that is in many different sites or in many different spots within, say, the liver or the lungs, and there chemotherapy plays the primary role for treating these patients. And chemotherapy has evolved over the years. The first chemotherapeutic agent that was found to be effective was developed in 1959 by scientists at Roche that basically determined in a very rational way, and this in many ways is the first targeted chemotherapy agent, found out that the building blocks of DNA and RNA can be manipulated by adding a fluorine atom to the standard molecule. And by adding a fluorine atom instead of a hydrogen atom, you can gum up the machinery, the enzymatic machinery of the cancer, and sort of create defective DNA or RNA. And for many years, 5-FU was really the only drug that we could use for this disease. Subsequently, other agents were developed, a drug called irinotecan, which basically also sabotages the division of cells into subsequent cells. Then we found a drug called oxaliplatin, which is basically composed of platinum, like you would find on a ring. And this agent basically gums up the DNA and prevents it from unraveling. Since then, we've gone on to what we call the molecularly targeted agents, drugs that have been rationally designed to target weaknesses in colorectal cancer. The first drug was a drug called bevacizumab, which basically is an antibody that attacks a molecule that stimulates blood vessel development in cancer cells or in the tissue surrounding cancer cells and allows oxygen to be delivered to these cancers. And by basically strangling the blood supply for these cancers, this is how this agent works, by preventing oxygen from going to the cancer. And without oxygen, the cancer can't survive. We've also developed drugs called cetuximab and panitumumab, which are other targeted agents. These are antibodies that latch onto the outside of the cancer cell and prevent a pathway that actually immortalizes cancer cells. And this has been found to work in a particular subgroup of patients, those patients that have mutations in something called KRAS, or who do not have mutations in KRAS. And basically, these particular tumors respond very nicely to these targeted antibodies that latch onto the outside of the cancer cell. So basically, we use all of these drugs together to try to fight colon cancer, and often we combine them together in various regimens. The frontline treatment for metastatic colorectal cancer typically includes this 5-fluorouracil drug. We often give a vitamin called leucovorin to make it work better, and then we often add either irinotecan or oxaliplatin to further enhance the activity. And we also add this drug bevacizumab to cut off the blood supply to the cancer. So this is often the frontline treatment for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. Now, we often go to subsequent lines of therapy, and we typically use the agents we didn't use up front. What has been found repeatedly is that patients do best if they've been exposed to all of the active agents for this disease. And really, that's one of the paradigms, is that we really try to treat these cancers with all of the available and effective agents that that can be used. And patients have, over the past decade, lived much, much longer with chemotherapy than previously. We've almost tripled the life expectancy for patients with this disease, with metastatic colorectal cancer. So really, significant advances have been made. Part of this also has to do with the care team. It's not just the medical oncologist who treats patients. A surgical oncologist obviously is involved, if particularly the cancer is called oligometastatic, where we might have to do a liver resection or a lung resection. Sometimes a radiation oncologist is involved if there are isolated bone metastases. We often will treat those with radiation therapy. Or if it's a rectal cancer, even if it's spread, sometimes we give radiation therapy to reduce the discomfort or pain that can sometimes be caused by growing tumor in the pelvis. Other team members are equally important. We have our infusion nurses who give excellent care to our patients who infuse the chemotherapy. There are often program nurses who take care of prescriptions who take care of insurance company issues as needed. One of the most important players are the nutritionists that help patients find the right diet to help them gain weight or prevent them from losing weight. Social workers can be key because there's a lot of problems that can occur with patients, patients who can't work, families who need help in finding various resources that might be needed. And increasingly, we're also seeing alternative medicine practitioners, acupuncturists, massage therapists, people who can help in many other ways for our patients with metastatic disease. So really, it's a big team that helps patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. And in many ways, the medical oncologist is sort of the quarterback of a big team, and we all work together to try to create the best outcome for our patients.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ensinger. That's an excellent, really very comprehensive and informative presentation and really has really sets the stage for all the rest of the program today. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. David Ryan. And Dr. Ryan is Clinical Director, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. He's Associate Chief, Hematology Oncology, Department of Medicine. He's Director, Tucker Gosnell Center for Gastrointestinal Cancers, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Ryan is going to address new treatment approaches, the role of clinical trials, and how research contributes to your treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Ryan.
Thanks, Carolyn. So there are two new treatment options that will be coming out this current year. One is called aflibercept, and the other is called regorafenib. Now, while they're two new treatment options, they're kind of cousins, so to speak, of bevacizumab or Avastin that Dr. Ensinger talked about. They're cousins in that they both target the same protein called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF. Both of these drugs, aflibercept and regorafenib, target the VEGF pathway, VEGF for short, and the regorafenib targets it orally. Both of these drugs were associated with improving the survival of patients with colon cancer in phase 3 studies that were reported out this last year. Now, they don't improve the survival by a lot, meaning by a year or more, but they do seem to provide several months of improved benefit. So that is a nice lead-in to clinical trials. What are clinical trials, and how do patients with colon cancer get involved with clinical trials? Well, clinical trials come in three types: phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3. When a drug is being developed in the lab and the scientists feel that it's ready for testing in people with certain types of cancer, they first bring it to the clinic in a phase 1 study. The purpose of a phase 1 study is to find the right dose and schedule of a drug, either alone or in combination with standard treatment. Once they find that right dose and that right schedule, they then take it into phase 2 studies. Phase 2 studies are done in all the different types of cancers. So you will do a phase 2 study in colon cancer, or a phase 2 study in breast cancer, or a phase 2 study in lung cancer. And in those types of trials, typically 30, 40, or 50 patients are enrolled, all with the same type of cancer, and we look to see what the overall effect of that particular drug or combination of drugs is. If that effect looks promising, we then launch into a phase 3 study. Now, phase 3 studies are the ones that patients get very nervous about, because often those are the randomized studies which may or may not include placebos. patients are randomly assigned to either get the standard treatment or the experimental treatment. And the experimental treatment could be the experimental treatment alone or the experimental treatment plus the standard treatment. And so those are the studies that lead to a drug registration, and both of those drugs that I talked about, aflibercept and regorafenib, recently were the subject of phase 3 studies where they showed an improvement in overall survival. So when you're considering a clinical trial, it's very important to know which phase the clinical trial is in. Typically at most cancer centers, you can be offered a clinical trial at any step along the way. You can be offered a clinical trial as part of your treatment for the first time, for the second time, or for the third time. And every step along the way, you're always going to have the option to either do the standard treatment or to do the clinical trial. And the way the clinical trial might inform you is that oftentimes in the discussion that the doctors have to have or the nurse practitioners have to have with you about entering onto the clinical trial, they'll typically call it the informed consent discussion. They will have to describe how it's different from the standard treatment. And so it's very informative and very educational to go through that process and ask your physicians what's available in clinical trials. And if there are no clinical trials available at your center, the physicians and nurse practitioners will often be familiar with other types of clinical trials that are going on at different places at that stage of disease. One of the interesting things that's happening in the world of colon cancer and in the world of cancer in general is the new world of targeted therapy. So what does that mean? It means that we are targeting specific pathways that are abnormal in cancer compared to the normal tissues. So how do we figure that out? Well, we take your pathology, either from your biopsy or in the case of colon cancer, from people who've had a colon cancer resected, we'll actually take slides from the pathology laboratory and look in your tumor for different genetic mutations that have occurred. Those genetic mutations in colon cancer, which we think might be important, are things like a BRAF mutation or a PI3 kinase mutation, or as Dr. Enzinger just mentioned, the KRAS mutation. In clinical trials right now, in phase 1 and in phase 2 studies, are drugs that are targeting tumors that have each of those different types of mutations. It gets very complicated, but all the great successes that we've seen in the last several years in melanoma, in lung cancer, in breast cancer, have all been around targeting specific pathways that we know to be abnormal. And we know them to be abnormal typically because the tumor has mutated the genes that make proteins involved in those pathways. And so we are targeting those specific pathways with inhibitors typically that drug companies and others have developed. And typically those studies right now for the purposes of colon cancer are phase 1 and phase 2 studies. They're in early drug development. And so it's very important when you're at your physician's office to ask about targeted therapy and also ask about tumor genotyping. The reason why clinical trials are incredibly important in terms of your discussions with your physician team is that you will always gain insight into the best possible care for you. So when you're sitting down with your doctor, there's always three global options that you have. You can do the standard therapy, you can do a clinical trial, or for people who have slow-growing tumors, you can do what we call watch and wait or expectant management. To understand the pros and cons of each of those approaches, the physician or the nurse practitioner will have to explain to the best of their ability what the standard of care entails, what the clinical trial entails and how it differs from the standard of care, and how any one of those two options is actually better than just watching and waiting and seeing what happens, particularly for those folks who feel fine and have very slow-growing tumors. So the process of going through that will inevitably bring up the issue of targeted therapy and of tumor genotyping. I can tell you that all the exciting studies that we're doing for folks with metastatic colorectal cancer is in the area of targeted therapy, and all of our trials that we have open are looking for folks who have specific genetic mutations in their cancer that we can target. And that's how it all wraps together.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ryan, for just an excellent presentation, very informative, very comprehensive, and actually very enlightening in terms of the whole clinical trial process and also what's new. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Lowell Anthony. Dr. Anthony is professor of medicine at the Division of Medical Oncology, Markey Cancer Center, University of Kentucky. And Dr. Anthony is going to really address really all of the overview of common side effects, some of the common side effects that many of you experience, the management of the side effects and pain and discomfort, and your quality of life concerns. It's a very important area in the cancer treatment area, and it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Anthony.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a real pleasure to be talking to so many people today about how to manage some of the side effects of what we do to treat colorectal cancer. And I'd like to start off with simply saying that as healthcare practitioners, we realize how challenging it is to communicate with patients. And we realize that when patients have problems, it may be challenging on their end to communicate with their healthcare team. So I'd like to just simply start off to say that it's not too shocking to know that when you talk to your healthcare team and the team talks to you, the communication is not perfect. And when side effects are explained to you, it works out that about a third of what's being said to you actually gets through. And how do we go about trying to teach and to communicate better? And one of the techniques that I would certainly encourage is to bring a family member with you, and if that's not possible, maybe consider recording the session where you can go back and listen, or somebody else can assist you when you go home to understand what's been said to you. So with that as a background, I simply really want to say to communicate, communicate, communicate. I think in the real estate business, we know it's location, 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 but in the management of side effects of cancer treatment, it's really communication. Tell your healthcare worker what's going on. Tell them what you feel. On a pain score, it becomes as important as a vital sign. We can consider it a vital sign. So try to learn what that scale is, 1 to 10. You can't go above 10. You can't have a pain of 11. It doesn't exist. A pain scale of 10 means that you've just been run over by a Mack truck, and it doesn't get any worse than being run over by a Mack truck. Even if the Mack truck backs up and runs back over you, it's still a 10. So we'd like to minimize all aspects of pain. We'd like to minimize all aspects of cancer treatments, but unfortunately, life is not a perfect world, and we do have side effects to deal with. When we think about treatment of colorectal cancer, what patients obviously are most concerned about is what they look like. You know, this is the treatments that we use usually do not result in a lot of hair loss, so your way you look is not going to dramatically change. And the next thing is nausea. Am I going to get sick and throw up? We do a much better job now than we have in the past in anticipating what those side effects are and managing those side effects. The next one is diarrhea. We would like to prevent all these. We can do a better job probably preventing nausea and vomiting than we may preventing diarrhea. The drug called irinotecan is one which we want to give a drug like Imodium or loperamide to people even before we give irinotecan because of the side effect is so strong of diarrhea, and continue the loperamide for a day or so afterwards until the risk for diarrhea becomes less. So the other side effects that we're concerned about from a life-threatening standpoint is clearly myelosuppression, and this is a fancy word simply meaning that your risk for infection and bleeding goes up as drugs that are given to you can suppress your marrow-forming elements. And unfortunately, there's no way of completely blocking this. Most of the drugs we use initially, oxaliplatin and 5-FU, depends on the dose and the schedule they're given, but they're not as some of the most suppressive ones that we associate with cancer treatment. Irinotecan at higher doses certainly is more myelosuppressive, and we really have to tell people that at the onset of fever, fever is defined as 100.5 degrees Fahrenheit, that you have to come in for assessment. You can't call in and wait for someone to call back. You show up at your closest healthcare facility, whether it's 2 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, for evaluation, and let them worry about getting hold of your healthcare team. So what can we do to minimize some of these side effects, and particularly the neuropathy or the tingling and the numbness that's associated with oxaliplatin? Well, one of the things that you can do is avoid cold air or cold things to touch. The drug oxaliplatin is used to treat colorectal cancer when it has spread to the lymph nodes and been completely resected. It's also used when the disease is not completely resected and is present in the liver, mostly in other places in the body. So with oxaliplatin, unfortunately, you are going to get some tingling in the fingertips and the toes. It seems that each dose, it might last a little bit longer. Things that make it worse are touching something cold or breathing cold air. Let your healthcare provider know about these kinds of things. They can't totally prevent it. Some people think that if we slow the infusion down, extend the infusion time, that might make it less. We don't have any simple way of managing this particular side effect that we all wish was not present. The management of pain comes into us from a variety of different sources in terms of how we get our leads here. We want to control pain with the least amount of medicine that's available and possible. So it's going to start off with over-the-counter types of drugs, acetaminophen or ibuprofen. These drugs may be used. We probably would prefer acetaminophen with ibuprofen. You possibly, if your platelets go low, you possibly could increase chance of bleeding. So we would probably prefer Tylenol or acetaminophen up front. For particularly non-myelosuppressive regimens, ibuprofen may be an option. We move pretty quickly from over-the-counter drugs like Tylenol, acetaminophen to narcotics in combination with acetaminophen and some in combination with ibuprofen. So this is the next step up. We use drugs that would last just for maybe a few hours. It's not merely meant to suppress pain all the time. So we go from taking pain medicines intermittently to now taking pain medicines on a scheduled basis when pain is going to be present all the time. And the basis for chronic suppression would be morphine, MS-Contin would be, or any extended release morphine would be an option. These drugs do come in oral. They come in patches depending upon how best to administer them. And that will move us on to quality of life concerns. And again, quality of life is going to be impacted, hopefully just for a short term as it relates to getting the treatment underway. But if the side effects of quality of life is being impacted, I think letting the healthcare team know exactly in what way that's going to be impact. I usually talk to patients about taking chemotherapy as being a full-time job. Some people can manage to do maybe lighter work, physical work with taking chemotherapy, but generally depends on the circumstances. A short-term disability is something a bit more reasonable to do because you really cannot anticipate how your body's going to react on the front end, and then it's best not to undergo additional stress by having to satisfy a boss or an employer in a scheduled continuous manner. So work with your social workers, work with your healthcare team to assess getting benefits and to make things less stressful as you go through these kinds of treatments. So I'll just stop right there, Carolyn, and turn it over to you and be available for questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Anthony, as always, for just a wonderful presentation and really for highlighting the importance of really managing these side effects and working with the healthcare team around it, and also working with social work staff and other staff so that you don't, one doesn't overstress oneself with all the other responsibilities of life. So thank you. Excellent presentation. Our next speaker is Diana Bearden, Ms. Bearden, and she is a supervisor of clinical nutrition at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Ms. Bearden is a dietitian, and she's going to address the nutritional concerns and give you some tips, which I know is a very important topic for everybody on this call. And I'm going to now turn the program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm here to discuss helping all of y'all with side effect management as it relates to diet. And one of the goals when we look at diet is getting enough calories and protein in each day within helping you at the same time manage any side effects you may be experiencing. Fluid is oftentimes left off the list, but that's also a very important component of your diet that needs to be addressed as well. Some of the common side effects patients experience during treatment include nausea and vomiting, a poor appetite, taste changes, possibly mouth sores, diarrhea, and these are very uncomfortable things to experience, and there are times when you need assistance beyond what the diet can provide. But what I want to give you today are just some tips that may help as kind of a frontline attack to addressing some of these. So if you're experiencing things like nausea and vomiting or a poor appetite, some things you can try and do is eliminate foods that have offending odors, and this may change throughout your treatment. The smells and the taste of foods a lot of times can be affected from treatment. Some of the chemotherapies and other medications you may be taking can have an effect on this. So this may be an evolving issue for you throughout your treatment that you want to take note of and be aware of what triggers you. Important things to remember is try and always keep something on your stomach. And to do this, what we encourage are very bland items, such as maybe some dry crackers or toast. We don't want a lot of times to introduce something very spicy or very sweet or something that's maybe fried or greasy, because that can aggravate the symptoms and potentially cause other things to occur. So we look at the bland items to keep something on your stomach without resulting in other side effects. Another tip that we encourage patients to consider trying is eating foods at room temperature. It was mentioned earlier about some of the chemotherapies can have interesting reactions when they're infused in our system, and one of them can be the temperature of items and food or anything, for that matter, with the cold, for example, with the oxyplatin. But eating things at room temperature can be an option. Most of the time when things are at room temperature, they have less odor, and so that may also hit the issue with the offending odors as well. Another thing to remember is good oral care, and we can address this very simply by, you know, encouraging patients to remember to brush their teeth more often, kind of cleansing their palate. A lot of patients will do maybe an oral wash with some baking soda and water just to clean their palate and rinse their mouth out. Dehydration can play a role in this as well, and you know, if you're dehydrated, a lot of times that can affect when you go to eat, you know, making sure that you have enough saliva production and the foods tasting like they should, and you manipulating them like you're used to having them when you eat them. Eliminating stress at your mealtime is another suggestion we give. And, you know, going through treatment is stressful in itself, but a lot of times there are other, you know, issues that go along with that, you know, trying to be somewhere at a certain time, and I need to remember to eat, and that can actually be stressful for some patients. So, you know, that can, when we have a lot of stress around us and throughout our day, it can affect our digestion. And so encouraging patients to just try and, you know, eat in a relaxed atmosphere, make sure your clothes are loose, that you're not, you know, wearing anything that's uncomfortable, sitting up after meals, all of that can help with digestion as well. like I said earlier, at times medication may be needed, and that would be a topic to discuss with your medical team, because there are a lot of other factors to consider before starting medications to help with appetite, nausea and vomiting, and things like that. Taste changes is another common side effect that patients experience, and I mentioned a little bit earlier about good oral care, and I'm going to continue with that when we talk about taste changes. But a lot of the times patients will either have no taste to their food. Sometimes food will taste differently than they have in the past, and so what we encourage patients to remember is trying things that you've never tried before. A lot of times those foods will taste good when in the past they didn't. If you're experiencing a metallic-y taste, try switching your utensils to plastic and avoiding drinking out of cans and switching to glassware. Another thing is there are certain foods that to enhance when you have no flavor at all, you're not tasting anything, a lot of times your citrus foods will be something that will remain the same. And interestingly enough, as long as you don't have mouth sores, this is something you can try, such as lemons and oranges and other citrus items. And if you are experiencing mouth sores, number one, you want to let your healthcare team know, because there are some medications they can give to help with that, as far as a swish and swallow or a rinse, for examples. But what we would recommend from a nutrition standpoint is, of course, choosing foods that are very soft and moist and easy to chew, avoiding things that are rough and that can poke your mouth, such as chips and crackers sometimes can even be a problem unless you can moisten them before, so those are things to consider. Avoiding spicy foods that can irritate your mouth and things that are very salty, because that would cause additional pain. Cutting foods into small bites, even maybe pureeing some of your items is an option. That'll just ensure that the food is very tender and soft going into your mouth. And then, of course, staying nice and hydrated. Hydration is very, very important. And it's oftentimes overlooked, you know, when we're trying to consume enough calories and protein, et cetera. But hydration is very important, and you can drink some of your calories. So be sure to talk with your dietitian about some guidance on what might be appropriate. A lot of times, diarrhea is a common side effect, and what we want to make sure to do is be aware of what you're eating and incorporate foods that can help with your bowel function. Some foods can actually aggravate and enhance the diarrhea, such as very sweetened and sugary foods or foods that are made with sugar alcohols, and a lot of times this is labeled as a sugar-free food. So it's very important for you to be aware of the amount of juice that you're drinking. A lot of times patient family members mean well, and they're trying to get you to, you know, get the calories, and so they're having you eat cakes and desserts and sweets, when in actuality that may be not the best thing for you if you're experiencing diarrhea. Getting the appropriate type of fiber in your diet is important, and an insoluble fiber may be something to consider. There is a lot of different causes for diarrhea. It's not just usually, you know, across the board the same cause, so you need to be aware and understand what is causing your diarrhea to help target how to address it. Staying hydrated, and I've mentioned this throughout my talk, is very important. And if you're experiencing a lot of diarrhea, you may need something beyond just our standard hydration methods, such as water and kind of the things we normally grab out of the fridge. And there are some items, such as Pedialyte is a good replacement for GI losses. So if you're having diarrhea, that may be an option for you to consider and talk about with your healthcare team. Sport drinks are helpful, but they are actually designed more for whenever we perspire, and the electrolyte composition that we release when we're perspiring, and not so much as it's not as synonymous with our GI losses. So drinking in a fluid, but then knowing when you maybe need to change that type of fluid to replace some that you may have lost from, you know, diarrhea, for example. I hope this has been helpful. And Carolyn, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Redden, for an excellent presentation. Really, you know, all these tips in terms of are so essential in terms of adding to the discussion with also Dr. Anthony in terms of just quality of life. And so you've given some really very practical things that our participants can do that are nutritionally based and can help them. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. And Elizabeth Ezra is an oncology social worker, and she is a program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Ezra is going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care. And it's my pleasure to turn the program over to my colleague, Liz, who's going to discuss these services with you.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker and work with many people with metastatic colorectal cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs include individual counseling, support groups, either over the phone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical health and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how to diagnose a cancer, how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situation and have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a colorectal cancer support group over the phone as well as online. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call us at 1-800-813-4673 or on our website at www.cancercare.org. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you very much, Liz, for actually so eloquently presenting to the audience all of the different services that they can access from Cancer Care. And now we do have time for questions. I'm going to ask Carolina to bring all of our speakers on board here, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, you'll please call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that number at the end of the call as well. And actually, Carolina, if you could explain to our participants how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many as we can.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And we have a question from the line of Ron R. Please go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to ask the question, if a sample is taken of the tumor and the pathologist says that it is well differentiated, is this a better predictor for success in following up treatment?
Well, thank you for that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Ensinger if you would address that question.
Sure. Well-differentiated tumors do have prognostic significance, particularly in patients who have had all of their tumor resected, patients who are stage 2, stage 3 cancers. For metastatic disease, it becomes less important because the response to chemotherapy there is most important. Patients who respond to chemotherapy have a better prognosis than those who do not. But in the adjuvant setting, in patients who have fully resected cancer, we do use well-differentiated versus poorly differentiated as a prognostic factor that sometimes determines if we recommend chemotherapy or not, but independently also has some prognostic significance.
Our next question. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Roberta C. Please go ahead.
Hi, great presentation. Two questions. Someone who has polyps from a routine colonoscopy, are they at greater risk of colorectal cancer later on, even though per biopsy they were negative? And in terms of nutrition, are you recommending, I guess this would be for the dietitian, avoiding processed meats, you know, high-fat diet, you know, red meats and so forth?
Well, thank you for that question. That's an excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Anthony to address the first question about the polyps and in terms of whether that implies any increased risk. Dr. Anthony, could you address that?
Polyps come in different flavors. There's ones that are on a stalk and ones that are not on a stalk, and there's specific ones that they may call hyperplastic. There may be tubulovillous adenomas. So what's really good when you talk about polyps is talk to the endoscopist about what type of polyp, and they will give you recommendations as it relates to the next colonoscopy, and it will be based upon the type of polyp, how many polyps in your family history. So polyps are thought to potentially be a precursor for colon cancer. But there's different types, and not all polyps obviously lead to cancer. So, but we have to take them very seriously, as if the polyps that someone could have or do have could lead to cancer. So that is looked at as a cancer precursor.
So that's a really excellent question, and I guess the question about whether it increases risk should actually be asked to the physician, to the person who, the endoscopy physician. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so good training. Ask the question here, and then you can take it back to your treating healthcare team. And the second question, Diana Barron, could you address the issue of just food that is perceived as being more healthful? Could you comment on that?
Absolutely. Really what we're encouraging patients to consume is more of a plant-based diet. And when we look at a plant-based diet, we look at a plate that is 75% from a plant source. This includes whole grains, our fruits and vegetables, and 25% of our plate is to come from a lean protein source. We encourage fish and chicken to be the primary, kind of the first line meats and lean proteins to go to, primarily because in our fish, especially fish like salmon, trout, tuna, halibut, are going to be higher in omega-3s. And what we're trying to accomplish by having a plant-based diet is getting in the fiber, the healthy fats, the lean protein sources, and the phytochemicals and the antioxidants that we want in the diet that we've found that have been beneficial in reducing our cancer risk. So when we talk about avoiding red meats, what we're really trying to say is we want you to consume more of the foods that have been found to have positive functional properties, such as the omega-3s that are higher in our fish, than in red meats that tend to be higher in saturated fat. And with that, with the saturated fat in the red meats, they're not as high in the omega-3s, which have been found to be quite beneficial in a number of health conditions, including cancer. So I hope that answers your question.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Now, we have some questions from some of our online participants, and I actually want to address some of their questions because I think that so we have a question for Dr. Ensinger. Does Dr. Ensinger have any research speculation why we're seeing a relative spike, doubling in a decade, in metastatic colorectal cancer for those under 40 years old, from Vincent? And Dr. Ensinger, could you address that question?
I'm actually not aware of there being a spike in colon cancer for patients under the age of 40. I asked Dr. Ryan or Anthony if they're aware of that. Generally speaking, the incidence of colon cancer has been going down. Maybe perhaps as a percentage basis it's going up because the sporadic cancers we're treating more aggressively or we're preventing them from occurring, but I'm not aware that that's happening. I defer to my colleagues.
Dr. Ryan, Dr. Anthony, do you have any comments to add? Or?
So there have been, there was a news report suggesting perhaps, possibly, there was an increased and it came from a study. But as Dr. Enzinger points out, that this is nothing near definitive, and it's hard to know for sure because the statistics that we keep on this aren't all that rigorous either across the board. So it is very difficult to know for sure what's going on in the younger patient population.
And Dr. Anthony, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think at this point it's too early for us to make any real conclusions that there's a higher risk right now. We do know that colorectal cancer and cancers in general in younger people can be a bit more aggressive. But what we would also be thinking that there could be some genetic basis as well the younger these patients are, and sometimes those are a little bit more difficult to treat.
Thank you. So, Vincent, thank you for the question, and it sounds like it was something in the news, but not really properly totally researched. And I guess I'm going to ask our speakers to address that actually just briefly in terms of, so the news, the people do have the news, the web, all these different sources of getting information. So the question is its credibility, and I wonder if Dr. Anthony, do you want to just comment on that, because that is an issue that comes up a lot.
Yeah, we hear quite often advances being made either in the diagnosis or treatment of a variety of different cancers. And these kinds of things that may come from a single study. Anything that's really promising needs to be validated. I think the latest I heard a week or so ago was some vaccine that you could take for pancreas cancer. And this was on a Fox News report that a patient told me about. And I think it was, it's what gets put into the question is a lot of more issues as it relates to what are they specifically describing? Are they describing something that they're willing to still recruit patients for clinical trials? People think that they hear something and they can just, that becomes instantly available, and it's not really the way it works. There's early reports that come out, and those early reports may or may not be true. Frequently, they're hypothesis generating, meaning that they need to be tested in a larger basis in a scientific manner where there's a rigorous control group.
Thank you very much. Thanks. And we have another question from Catherine. What would you recommend for unknown primary, but they are going to treat as colon cancer? Dr. Ryan, could you address that?
So that's an interesting, very interesting question. So the issue of unknown primary was a big one when I was a fellow in the mid-1990s. And since then, we've been able to, with the help of our pathologists and with special stains and different molecular pathology techniques, we can pretty much narrow down where we think the cancer first started. And of course, how we treat cancer is based upon where we think it started or where the primary tumor was. And so oftentimes somebody will come with metastatic disease and we're not quite sure where it started, but with the biopsy, we can narrow it down to often the GI tract, and oftentimes something will look very much like a colon cancer primary. And typically at that point, as long as all the pathology is consistent with the clinical picture, we'll go ahead and start somebody on a regimen that is intended for metastatic colorectal cancer. So something, for instance, like FOLFOX and bevacizumab, or FOLFIRI and bevacizumab. And that's a fairly common scenario.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And we have another question from Darcy. How important is radiation therapy in the overall treatment and prognosis of metastatic colon cancer? And Dr. Enzinger, again, could you answer that just in a general way? But
Certainly. Radiation therapy has is being used less now than it was maybe a decade ago for metastatic colorectal cancer. On the other hand, there are new technologies that are being used that are increasing its use. Generally speaking, for metastatic disease, the goal is to try to reduce pain and discomfort. And often the cancer will spread to the bones, and these can become quite painful. So radiating those spots can reduce the discomfort and also retard the growth of the cancer in those areas. It can also prevent the weight-bearing bones from breaking, and that's often a very important preventative step to take. In some cases, radiation therapy has already been given. For instance, in patients who have a recurrence of rectal cancer, if rectal cancer is localized, it's often treated with radiation therapy up front as one of the treatments. And then patients can sometimes have a recurrence. Generally, we don't like using radiation therapy in the same field again, but there can be situations where stereotactic radiation therapy or cyberknife therapy can be used again. There are technologies also being used for isolated liver metastases. At Dr. Ryan's institution at Massachusetts General Hospital, for instance, they're using proton beam therapy for isolated liver lesions to take care of those spots. There are other technologies that are also being used, various ways of enhancing radiation therapy to treat patients with metastatic disease. One of the things that I would emphasize is that these are treatments that are either meant to reduce pain or discomfort, but once the cancer is diffuse, once it is in many different parts of the body, the best treatment is chemotherapy. Treating just one spot at a time is often like the little boy in the dike. If you're focusing on one site of cancer, often the other sites grow, and it really doesn't necessarily help the patient unless we're really just trying to alleviate pain at a certain spot.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And I really want to thank all of our speakers today. It's really been outstanding. I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions both on the telephone and online as well, and all of you who've been listening. And I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour education program, and that in planning a program like this, we do recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. And I do want to remind all of you that you can access all the services of cancer care. We are simply a telephone call away, and you can call us at 1-800-813-4673. And our staff of 45 master's-level trained oncology social workers are here to help you, and they help with lots of different things, from practical and financial assistance to counseling, both individual counseling on the telephone and online, as well as support groups. And I think, as Liz has said, both on the telephone and online as well. And we have lots of workshops like this, and we also offer a number of materials, fact sheets, and booklets as well. So that when in doubt, do not hesitate to call us. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer, with colorectal cancer, with metastatic disease. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support, and we are here to help you. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.